Hello and welcome to the Selection Committee podcast, the second edition of the of such. My name is Monty, and the next voice you're going to hear is Dan. And we are here to talk about private draft leagues. Drafts are already very much in train at the moment. I think there's already been a bunch of Ultimate 41s been posted. There's plenty of AFL Fantasy Elite ones going, and the Supercoach Draft. I'm sure that's going on as well. And there's a lot of questions that that listeners out there will have about how to draft, and that's obviously what we're here to talk about. Because this is the time of year when drafting strategy is all the rage, and those of us who've played fantasy draft competitions for other sports have some idea of what to do. But it's almost as if, I mean, because there's so little in the way of infrastructure around these leagues, we're almost sort of making it up as we go along. I'm seeing a lot of people going into these drafts not having done a whole lot of research and just sort of relying on their knowledge of draft leagues from other sports.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I mean, I feel in a way like it's learning from the start again in some ways. I actually haven't done a draft yet, but I'm really curious as to how it's going to go. I mean, I've tried to do quite a lot of research because, as you're alluding to there, it's not quite as easy as just sort of jumping in blind going, I know a fair bit about footy anyway, because there's a lot of numbers to sort of have to take in, and you know, it's a bit more complex. And you know, we all spend a lot of time setting up our dream team and super coach, and doing every little bit of research for that. So pretty much the same principle applies for this.
Yep. Look, I mean, it is a bit confusing, and you might sign up for, say, an AFL Fantasy Elite league, and you'll sit there, and the first page they take you to after the sign-in process is a big long list of players, which is your pre-draft list. So pre-draft listing is a very important part of preparing for the draft, because it helps you, because when you're in the draft, obviously it's very time sensitive. You only get, you know, somewhere between 30 and 90 seconds, depending on what the league settings are, for your draft, for those live drafts especially, if you do have a live draft, and a lot of people do. And the preparation is the thing, because it's a very chaotic set of circumstances. Anything could happen, and people could pick players who you don't expect. And so preparation, and this is why, especially in America, private draft leagues generate a lot of money. It's a huge industry over there, because you need to do so much research, and you need to have all these cheat sheets and things. I don't know about you, Dan. I'm a big fan of using cheat sheets. I've even bought a couple in my time in my NFL fantasy career. Have you had a look at some of the cheat sheets that are going around at the moment?
For AFL?
That's right. I think there's one that I'm not sure they've actually put it out yet, but Footy Profit's about to put one out.
Yeah, they put it out yesterday or the day before, and I've only had a quick look at it. Look, you know, pretty snappy, and there was some you know, pretty good reference material in there, and they've sort of been running the line. It's, you know, it's not necessarily a cover to cover read, but there's a lot of information in there that will be very handy.
And I suppose the Bible is, I suppose, the most credible of these you know, Bibles, if you like, is of course the AFL Prospectus, done by yeah. Champion Data. So, but I guess the thing when we talk about cheat sheets, that's actually part of the preparation, is that it's actually very much possible to over sort of dive in too far to information, and then when it comes to the draft, you've got all this stuff in your head, and that is what a cheat sheet is for. It's all set down in an easily digestible format. You can look it up quickly. You don't have to, you know, you don't get confused when things go wrong or things go the way you don't expect them. So this is a big part of your pre-draft preparation, is finding one that you like and using that, or using it as a basis, or developing one yourself. This is something which it's going to get more seamless in future years, but just at the moment, we're still making up as we go along, Dan.
Yeah, well, for me, I've always traditionally used my own pre-draft rankings list, as you know, if I've had a bit of time to put into that, you know, leading up to a draft, my own pre-draft rankings, you know, it gives myself a few cues, and I don't always go you know, pick for pick directly off the sort of my rankings that I'd done beforehand. But, you know, because different positions, you know, it might affect the way that your rankings go. Like, you know, if you've already got a ruckman early, you got a ruckman sort of next on the board on your pre-draft list, well, you're probably not going to take that ruckman then. You're just going to, you know, let him slide. But it sort of helps you because they're your thoughts, except they're right there in front of you at draft time.
Yep, look, there's a, actually, for those of you who like to read blogs, there is a new blog out there where there's a lot of, I mean, look, I suppose I've been talking a lot, listening a lot to experienced fantasy coaches in the last couple of weeks, and one thing that I've seen, no doubt you probably would have seen this as well, Dan, is that people have been complaining for a while about there being too much analysis, but I think the thing here is there's, I mean, without being unkind to a lot of our brethren in the industry,
yeah.
It is, you know, you do have to look a bit harder to find the wheat amongst the chaff. So there are, as I said, there's a new blog out there which hopefully will be a lot more wheat than chaff, and that's Dream Team Insider. They will be posting a lot in the next few weeks, obviously, about draft competitions, because they're the people behind the site are they're using pseudonyms, I believe, but they are former competition winners.
They're known to us at least, and we, you know, we do know that these guys are quality in the their thoughts on all forms of fantasy footy, and they've even put out an article that read very well about draft-based fantasy just recently.
That's exactly where I was going, Dan. Now, the one that's at the moment I can see on the site, which is the top one, is Apples and Oranges, which is their article about value-based drafting. Now, this is, I mean, I logged into, and I was invited into an AFL Fantasy Elite draft today, and I get to that page, as I said, where you have that list of the pre-draft rankings, and they have a default pre-draft ranking there of all these lists of names. Now, I come to that, and I see it must have been at least 15, if not the first 20 players, are all midfielders. Now, this is the problem, or the weakness in you know, setting out lists just based on point scoring, which is what this article, Apples and Oranges, on the DT Insider blog, which we'll put in the show notes to link to. This is something which we talked a little bit about last week, but they set it out there in full about how picking players just on their pure point scoring point scoring ability is not actually the way to win a private draft league. It is based on
unbalanced.
That's right. So it's based on positional scarcity. It's based on tiers of players who are all you know, figuring out how many players are all going to score about the same, and figuring out how rare those players are. And that means that if you don't have the number one ruck, forward, or back in your top 20, I mean, if you don't have a lot of those guys, I'm not saying they need to dominate, but because you still need to pick the highest midfielders. Because they are more valuable than especially the Swans and Abbots of this world. But you need to have a fair amount of those guys in at least your top 20 to make sure that you get value for your early picks. Otherwise, you're going to be left with six midfielders who each score, you know, average about 90 between them, and then just rubbish everywhere else in your positions. Dan.
Yeah, that's right. And something we chatted a bit about last week as well. But it's something. It's a point that you just can't stress enough, that don't get sucked into you know, someone who might average 105, 106 as a midfielder. If you've got the option to take a forward or a back who could maybe push 95, it's 10 points less, but the gap that the forward or defender, even ruckman, might have on his next you know, like player of the same position, that's the key. It's the gaps and that concept of tiers that you were talking about.
Yeah. So let's sort of drill down into the first couple of rounds. That's probably the I mean, obviously, as I think I said last week. Not a whole lot of fantasy games of this type are won in the first or second rounds, but it'll illustrate what we're trying to talk about here.
Well, perhaps you can lose it in the first couple of rounds, though.
That's true. I mean, it's a bit different because the scoring's a lot closer than what it is in say an NFL one, where the top running back could score 20% more than the next person. But that's not necessarily the case so much in AFL. I don't know. You probably had experience in NHL, where I suppose that'd be similar with the goalies, that there's such a big scoring differential between the top ones.
Yeah, you still at least have like a top few though. Like you've probably got, you know, three or four. You know, probably a similar thing with right wingers tend to be a bit harder to find.
Yep.
In NHL, there's sort of an elite couple, and then there's a bit of a gap.
Yep.
So I think to use that an AFL example. I feel that Dean Cox is the best example as someone who's, as a ruckman, clearly head and shoulders above his peers.
Yep. So, look, I mean, so if we're looking at a, and I suppose we need to couch this in the terms of we are not expecting a captain for the purposes of this analysis, because that skews everything, because that really means that you need to have the top midfielder as your number one pick. So that sort of screws things up. So
we touched on this last week. If you are a league admin, personally, I don't recommend utilizing captain scores whether you're doing category based or points based scoring, because it really throws the dynamics out of the first round or two.
Yep. So the first couple of picks, you can't go past Swan and Ablett. Now, it doesn't, as I said, I think we might have said last week, it doesn't really matter which one you get. It's just a matter of job security.
Right.
If you've got the number one or two pick, it's pretty hard to go past either of those guys, and you're probably not going to go wrong. And if you are going to go wrong, it's going to be essentially random. It's going to be depend on soft tissue injuries and you can't really predict that, I suppose.
No, that's right.
So look, I think as far as the first two picks, the first round is concerned, I actually wouldn't like picking somewhere between 3 and 5, because I think the problem for me, Dan, is obviously it'd be nice to have a Pendlebury, a Beams, or a Cochin, or a Boyd, but I feel like that's actually the period, even that early, where I'm not quite sure whether I want a Dean Cox or an Ivan Marek that early, or whether it's worthwhile. Because the problem is, of course, with these serpentine drafts, is if you're picking 3, for instance, in a 10-team league, you don't get the next pick until pick 18.
Yeah.
By which time, a lot of those premium backs, forwards, and rucks might have already gone. So you might be sitting there with Pendlebury and like Hamish McIntosh or something as your ruck, and it's just it's a lot less of a certainty. So, I mean, obviously, if Pendlebury falls to 3, then to 4, then that number 4 might think, well, happy days. But is that too early to be picking a Goddard, Cox, or Franklin?
I'd balk at it, and personally, I'd still go. There's a couple of midfielders that I'd go at pick 3, 4, 5. I agree with you, though. I wouldn't be overly comfortable with those picks, but probably for Pendlebury, Boyd, are the main two for me. I'd have a hard time picking anyone else in the top 4, so Swan, Ablett, Pendlebury, Boyd.
So you're saying Pendlebury and Boyd are in your second tier there?
Yeah, they're the first two blokes in the second tier, obviously behind Swan and Ablett.
Yeah. So I suppose the tier behind that. So you would go. I mean, we're assuming for the purposes of the analysis here that we're picking for each person who's at the at each spot. So Swan and Ablett would have gone 1 and 2. Whoever's picking 3 and 4 would have gone Pendlebury and Boyd. I mean, it's pretty hard to go past those guys. I mean, you're not going to lose the draft by getting those guys. I mean, unless something terrible happens, obviously.
Yeah, and I know Pendlebury has had that happen, broke his leg. Last year, but nothing terrible seems to happen to Boydie.
Yeah, well, Pendles, that can happen to anyone. What happened to Pendles? That's essentially random. That's not a chronic issue. Yeah. So I'm just looking at the Ultimate Footy rankings, and they have Beams here at number 4 because they reckon he's going to average a couple of points ahead of Boyd. But I mean,
he had a great season, but for me to invest a pick that early, I'd like to see a little bit more of it. Not saying that he can't average 116. In 2013, but I'd like to see him, you know, do it again this year before I could be sure he'll do it in 2014. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's there's also something to be said for a player who you can almost lock in to get 22 games, and that's something that Boyd can boast in a lot of previous years. I mean, I know he's getting on a little bit, but Boyd is probably more of a chance to get 22 games rather than Beams. I mean, and Beams might just be rested for as teams tend to do these days.
But, and as Nick Maxwell pointed out in a press conference earlier this week, that Collingwood will be resting players.
Yeah, so when Beams gets rested and you have to get someone off your bench, they could be scoring 40 points less. So the fact that Beams might actually average 116 over the course of 21 games, Boyd would actually be more valuable to your fantasy team, even if he averages 2 points less, because he plays those 22 games and you don't have to rely on someone from your bench or the waiver wire. So that's playing all 22 games is a valuable resource if you're a startable player in fantasy.
That's why Boyd's value is so high for mine, because he has got that huge point scoring potential, but he's got that extreme durability.
Yep. Now Cochin and probably Mark Murphy and Watson, I suppose.
They're definitely the next three midfielders for me, all ahead of Beam still for me.
Yes. Now, I would be comfortable in taking a Cox in front of any of those guys. If we're doing a ranking here, Cox would probably be ranked number 5 on our ranking list.
Yeah, I think that's where you look to start diversifying, and it'll change. Like, different drafters will have different views on it. I think that's the point to start diversifying. So whether it's with Dean Cox in the ruck, or Buddy Franklin in the forward line, or probably Goddard would be first cab off the rank for the backs. A little early for Goddard for mine, but I think that's where you start looking for someone who can play a different position.
It is interesting, like we're taking these projections on Ultimate Footy as gospel. So of the backs, you've got Goddard and Gibbs as the only players to average over 100 at about 101 each. And then the next back is Carrazzo at 96, and then Scotland, who of course is going to miss a couple of games, so you have to discount his numbers down to 94, 95. So in terms of tiers, the backs are almost as rare as the rucks at that sort of scoring level. So if we have Cox at, because rucks are the most scarce position on the ground, obviously.
And the drop up, you've already pointed out, a big drop off from sort of the top two backs, Goddard, Gibbs, down to the next group.
So,
it's a bit of a steeper slide for the ruckman.
Yeah.
So maybe not necessarily the top two, but as you sort of maybe get down to the third, fourth, and fifth ruckman, it's a pretty steep slide from where Dean Cox started.
That's right. So we have Cox projected at 101, and we have Sandilands, the second one. Now, of course, he's going to miss a bunch of games.
Yeah,
he was probably going to missing a bunch of games even before this particular injury that he's suffered from the last.
Now we know.
That's right. So we've locked in a certain amount of games lost, but I'm sure there'll be more over the course of the season. So Marek at 95, and then Ruffhead at 92, 93, I should say, and then Goldstein at 94. So. So I presume that means, if we look at the forwards, so it'd be Franklin at 102, Cox again, you have to treat him as a ruckman, I suppose, at 101.
I'd still play him in the forward line more than anything, though.
You reckon?
If you're going to draft Cox, yeah, play him in the forward line.
Ooh.
And you can get yourself if you're going to draft another ruck, early as well, just play these guys off against each other. If you've got a choice, between someone like Mitch Robinson and Ivan Marich, there's a case to be made for Marich there.
So, as far as the forwards go, as I said, so you've got Franklin Cox, Rockliffe, and Steve Johnson at about 100. And
there's Steve Johnson suspended for the first
game. For the first game, but one game doesn't really matter that much, I suppose. At that level, where we're talking just about the forwards rather than with the scarcity, obviously the Boyd and Beam comparison doesn't necessarily matter as much, because we're talking about a position that's a lot more scarce. Johnson, he might average 100 for the year, but you can probably knock that down a couple of points because he'll miss at least one. But even so, he'll average more than Robinson. Thomas, of course, who has got his own injury concerns going into the season.
His ranking's way, the projected ranking, that, you know, we've got a spreadsheet here from Ultimate Footy. Projection is a bit high for my liking because of such a limited preseason. I think it's really going to affect him this year. And it should affect his draft position too.
Yep. Pavlich there as well. Zaharakis. Now, wasn't there a... Zaharakis hasn't had the greatest preseason either, has he?
No, he hasn't had the greatest preseason. He had a quad nowhere near as bad as his, I think, last year when he was was a late out during the bye rounds. He tore a quad tendon.
Yeah.
So it was pretty serious. I think he's just done a little bit of a nick in his quad. I don't think he's named to play this weekend, but I don't think he's expected to be that far off. But yeah, I guess it is just a matter of how badly it affected his preseason.
Yep. Bartel and Zorko were sort of round out the top 50 or 60 or so. So there are a lot more names on that forwards list. So I suppose in terms of scarcity, we're looking at rucks first, then backs, and then forwards. So if we have Cox at five, so we've got those two, the Swan and Ablett, one and two, Pendlebury and Boyd, whichever way you want to put them around, three and four, Cox at five. So do you go with more midfielders from six down, or do you start going with your Goddards and Gibbs and Franklin's right then?
Well, I suppose if you're picking at six, and let's just pretend someone like Cox or Franklin's already gone, you'd still use the same philosophy. If you were willing to have picked Cox or Franklin at five, then you should be willing to pick the other one who slips through at six as well.
Yep.
It becomes a little bit more of a debate then. Yeah, if you go the leftover one of those guys, or yeah, if you go Koch and Murphy or Watson, I'd still be pretty comfortable diversifying a little bit there.
I think pick six. I think again, if you're picking six, you're then picking again at pick 14, which is obviously there's another. What's that? 7, 8, 9, 10. So there's 7, 8. Eight picks in between your next pick. So
I think you still get a Scott Thompson, Andrew Swallow.
That's right.
Or even like a very underrated Jack Redden.
You'll still get someone who's averaging around 105, 105 if you're lucky, maybe sort of hundreds, and I think that's perfectly fine for your top midfielder, because if you look at the amount of midfielders, actually now that we look at that, so if you're looking at Beams, projected 116, Cochin 113, Murphy 110, 111, Watson 108, so, I mean, you can't expect to get Buddy and one of those guys, but in terms of the differential between your second the next forward you get and the next midfielder you get, the drop-off is not nearly as big. So it's point differential rather than pure point scoring addition.
Yeah. I'll put it to you this way. Would you rather have Buddy and, say, Scott Thompson? Or would you rather have Cochin and, let's say, Steve Johnson or Tom Rockliffe?
Yeah. Look, I think the and there's the other aspect of that, if those four midfielders are gone, and you start getting Cox, is there going to start being a run on those guys? I mean, we see in a lot of other sports where the structure of a first round is pretty much set. I mean, in the NFL, it has been running backs, and they just keep on going down the line, and that has changed in recent years where quarterbacks have started creeping up, and obviously wide receivers now. It's going to be interesting to see for the purposes of AFL private draft fantasy leagues, whether it's going to start being, especially towards the end of the first round, whether non-mids are going to start proliferating, because I think in a really tight league where everyone actually knows what they're doing and has a lot of experience in other types of leagues, that is, I think, where the value is at the bottom end of the first round, is you're going on those non-mids, because you'd expect, because everyone's going to start doing that, I mean, the bottom end of the first round might go Cox, Franklin, Goddard, Gibbs, Johnson, and Marek, and then on the way back, those six guys all might take mids. So that ideally you would like to get out of the first rounds with a high ranking non mid and a good mid. So I suppose the problem, and then if you're one of those first four guys, you're going to get screwed on the flip side, because you're going to have, I mean, you're going to have Swan Ablett, Pendlebury, or Boyd, which is great. But then when it comes to pick 17, those guys are going to have slim pickings in terms of finding a good, you know, top flight non mid to pick from if they want to go mid and something else for the first two picks.
Yeah, I agree with your like sort of the concept there that you want a midfielder and someone else in the first two rounds.
Yeah, but I suppose the other aspect of that is that especially in this first year of the proliferation of the private draft league concept, people are going to have to be convinced away from two mids to start off with. So I think it's going to be the case where the knowledgeable drafters are going to be able to have rich pickings if they're in a league where not everyone knows what they're doing, because they're going to be able to pick those non mids and leave the top mids to the other guys, and they're going to win a lot of leagues that way.
I'd use that as a general rule of thumb though, because there's definitely circumstances where I would pick two midfielders in the first two rounds, and that would be based on how other people are drafting. Because let's say you're in a 10-team league, there's 20 picks in the first two rounds, so. Yep. If your second pick is something like 18, 19 or whatever, then if everyone took one midfielder and one someone else, well, we need to find 10 someone else's.
Yep.
So you know, look, how deep, like what sort of player are we talking about being the 10th best non-midfielder? So Franklin, Goddard, Gibbs, Cox, Rockcliffe, Steve Johnson.
Yeah, you start looking at mid.
It's already thin. That's thin at five. Yeah. Like even the sixth one, you're going, yeah, no, I'm taking another midfielder.
You're looking at Robinson, Thomas, and Pavlich at that sort of area. So
So I think you'd like to. You'd actually. It's more specifically, I think you want to get out of the first two rounds, and this might not even be in your control because they might already be gone by the time your second pick comes around.
Yeah.
But you want to get out of the first two rounds. One of Goddard, Gibbs, Cox, Rockcliffe, or Steve Johnson.
Yep. And there's going to be some people going home empty-handed as far as that goes, because there's not 10 of those guys out there. So
sorry, with that list, I forgot to mention Buddy Franklin.
Yep.
I think I started at Goddard there. So
yep.
there's six guys that I think that aren't midfielders that you take in the top 20.
Yep.
The gap's a little bit too big after that. So, yeah, not everyone's going to get the chance to get one mid and one sort of alternate position, but it should be a focus, but not your sole focus.
Which is why I think those guys who are at 3 and 4, who get Pendlebury or Boyd, those are the guys who are going to get screwed potentially.
That's because, nervous. You're really nervous to see if one of those guys does slip through to pick 18, 19.
Because, I mean, you might not like Robinson, or you might not trust Thomas's preseason, and you might not, you know, think Pavlich is, you might think he's too old, and you just might not want any of those guys. And
if that's the way you feel, like, don't reach for someone that you're not that confident with. You could go with someone nice and safe like a Sam Mitchell, who you'd probably get out at 18 or 19.
Well, actually, at 18 or 19, you'd actually probably still be looking at, a Joel Selwood or an Andrew Swallow or a Brett DeLeo.
Because obviously in that circumstance, a lot of other sort of backs, forwards and rucks had gone, or, you know, at least six of them had already gone, which pushes some midfielders out.
It's going to be fascinating to see. I hope that Ultimate Footy and other places publish some stats at the end of the year about how many teams won the flag going mid with their first two picks, because I'm tipping those guys are not going to be the ones who are most successful. It's going to be the ones mid something else. So, I mean, again, we can probably overanalyze this until the cows come home, but I suppose that gives you an idea of the sort of trade-offs that you have to make. And a lot of these happen all the way down the draft. So the same things apply with the amount of, when you're looking at tiers of potential scoring, and this is why you need to have a fairly detailed cheat sheet with projections of what you think everyone's going to score and how many games they're going to play. And I suppose that's the other thing which I've been spending a lot of time on today, which is a list of games projections, because it's all very well to project how many points a player is going to score per game they play. But we're talking about a full season fantasy game here, so it's almost more important to figure out how many games each player is going to play. So this is where When the big companies in America do their, like your ESPNs and Fox Sports and Yahoos and Sports Lines, and they publish projections and they update them every day on a weekly basis and also on an annual basis. So, as part of those projections, they have to balance everything so that they all make sense. So they can't assume that a team's going to play five wide receivers every set on every down in an NFL game. So that doesn't really happen. So they have to, and they have to, they can't assume that like three guys on a single team are all going to score two touchdowns, because I mean that assumes that the match is going to be a blowout. I mean, unless they're playing the Cleveland Browns, in which case it's probably realistic. But nevertheless, you do have to make these things realistic, and they have to do balance out. So I've been spending all day today getting a list together of each club's list, and figuring out how many games each player is going to play from each side. So I'll publish that list as part of the show notes, and obviously the people who are watching at fanfooty.com.au/selection, which is where the live show is published, is streamed, we'll be able to see that as well. So Dan, I think we'll spend the rest of the show going through this, because it's a bit involved, but it does merit some close consideration, because this is especially if you're doing your own projection, your own cheat sheet or your own draft research, this is an essential part of it. So we'll start with the Adelaide side. I've projected Daniel Taulia to come back from his poor season last year and play 22 games. Same with Ben Rutten.
What do you mean, poor season?
Well, now, didn't he? Well, he had an injury.
On the Rising Star Award.
Now, wasn't it the year before? Hang on, I'm thinking of someone else then, right? Oh, that's right. I might be thinking of Otten, that's right. He was the one who's come off the line.
Yeah, Taulia was fantastic. He was a revelation last year. Not a fantasy player,
that's
but
right.
A revelation.
That's right. So, yeah, so in terms of the three tall backs, I've projected Taulia and Rutten to play every game. And the third tall, I've sort of said, well, Andy Otten will have a bit, and Sam Shaw will have a bit, and Luke Brown will have a little bit as well.
No, he's a short, though.
He's a short, no. Who's the other one? Well, Ricky Henderson might play. Andy Otten, Sam Shaw, and Luke Thompson, who didn't actually, I don't think he played many games at all last year. I predicted him for zero, so
he only played a handful of games. He actually jumped in for the finals.
That's right. Yeah,
he played one home and away game, and then because of injuries, he came in for the prelim.
So that's going to be one of the positional battles in that Adelaide side, Otten versus Shaw.
The third tall, yeah.
The third tall. So who do you reckon is going to end up winning that battle? Who's going to get the majority of games?
Look, I'd have Andy Otten slightly ahead, slightly ahead of Sam Shaw. It sounds like he's had a pretty good pre-season. Otten, he's dropped a bit of weight to improve his speed and agility. He was never the quickest bloke, and unfortunately when he did his knee, he came back a little bit slower. But just got a bit of a feeling. But I think it's going to be a bit of a split between Otten and Shaw for that third tall spot.
So as far as the small defenders there at Adelaide, of course, there's no Michael Doughty this year. Brent Riley I've got playing 21. I've got Matthew Yench playing 22. Although he's classified as a back, but he might play forward now and again. Brody Smith played a lot of games last year, but he's got injured in the preseason. I'm not sure about his job security. Brody Martin there as well. I've got a couple of minutes.
I think Brody Smith's got fantastic job security, and I think he'll actually play a little bit higher up the ground this year, sort of more up on a wing.
Mm.
But obviously, when he gets over his injury, he broke his collarbone.
So the big question, I suppose, for fantasy purposes is, A, what is Richard Tambling going to do? How many games is he going to get? He got four last year, and I'll project him for four again, because I don't trust his preseason form. I don't trust his job security at all, and yeah, you look at that. Look at that structure in the back line, and I'm not sure Luke Brown can actually chip in for a whole lot of games unless one of those guys gets injured.
I actually think it's, and I know you haven't given Tambling too many games there. I got a feeling that Tambling's in a position to play a decent amount of footy this year alongside Riley as a small defender. I think Luke Brown will get some opportunities, but for me, it's Tambling's spot to lose.
Ooh, well, that's a big call. All right, onto the centres. So Mackay, Van Berlo, Sloan, Thompson, Vince, Dangerfield, they'll all get most
they're
of the games.
They're all staples, yep.
So in terms of the sixth midfielder, if we're looking at just the amount of six midfield rotations, Crouch and Joyce probably would be fighting over a spot. Yeah, they might each get a few goes at the one spot.
Yeah, got to admit, your six-game projection for Joyce surprises me a little bit.
Mm.
Well, I think those extra ones could go to Crouch. I reckon Crouch will play a fair bit this year. Mm. I don't think he'll miss heaps.
I mean, look, these projections, obviously, there could be a plus minus of at least two. So, I mean, if you look at this list later and you think, well, why is this guy going to miss two games? Why is he by playing 20? And what about this guy? I'd pretty much put a plus or minus two on these figures. Or at least I hope that there will be plus or minus two of these figures. One player you mentioned
I'd give Joyce's six I'd put that as a minus six.
All right. well, perhaps he might give some of his games to Cameron Ellis-Yeoman, because I think you were saying that...
Maybe he got talked up by Brenton Sanderson this week.
Mm.
He said he actually said we will see him debut at some stage this year. So.
Yes, well, I mean, that could just mean one game, so you don't know, but yes. Also, in the forwards, Matthew Wright, Richard Douglas, Ian Callinan, Jared Petrenko, and Taylor Walker, and Jason Porpleasia. So all six of those guys are pretty much going to be getting every game. I'm not sure there's a whole lot of room for Tom Lynch or Sam Kerridge, Dave.
That's right, but Matty Wright's going to spend a fair bit of time in the midfield as well, so maybe that's your that's that extra midfielder that we were sort of talking about before, because he spent a fair bit of time in the centre square giving Scott Thompson a chop out, because his stoppage stuff's really good.
Yep. Now, Lewis Johnson, they brought him in from Johnston. They brought him from Sydney. Do you not see him as getting a look in? Or is he just depth?
I think he's mostly just depth. Yeah, fleetingly you might get a few games.
Right, so Josh Jenkins will probably play the tall forward role, become ruckman, supporting Jacobs. So both of those guys are going to play games. McKernan,
props to not straight up calling it the Tippett role.
Yes, well, McKernan only got about half a dozen games last year, and I'm expecting to do the same this year. Based on matchups, I suppose. And Graham, I sort of threw a few numbers in there, but I wouldn't expect a huge amount of fantasy interest on either of those guys.
That's right.
On to Brisbane now. The back line. So we have in tall defenders. We have Merritt. We have Maguire. I'm expecting not to play as many games this year. McKeever didn't play a whole lot of games last year. I'm expecting to play even less this year. That third tall defender, it could be Lester, but Lester could play forward. It could be Patful, but Patful could play midfield, as he played a bit last year. I'm not quite sure about what's happening with that third tall at the role at Brisbane, Dan.
Yeah, I'd back Niall McKeever in. It sounds like he's coming along pretty well this pre-season, and you know, he's probably never going to be a world beater, but he is an Irish bloke, hasn't been playing the game too long, so I think he's shown some pretty good signs and signs of improvement.
Now, I have Jed Adcock. Of course, he's classified as a back, but he's probably going to play midfield, so he's probably pretty immune from talk about the structure in the back line, isn't he?
Yeah, he might play a little bit of half-back, as he did last year, but they've got a couple of really good rebounding options to play off there, so you're right, Adcock might be a bit more up the ground.
Hanley has been playing either a half-back flank, or he's been playing a bit of the Scotland role, the starting on the wing and sweeping back to defence. So.
Yeah, and I reckon that he's a really good attacking asset for them, so some of the chat this pre-season is that he'll move maybe up to the wing a little bit more.
Yep. Now, Golby, I think, is pretty much a lock for 20 to 22 games.
Injury permitting, I think he's one who could be a big improver this year. So from a draft perspective, I think he could be a bit of a sleeper.
Yep. Doherty, I've penciled him in for 16 games. That's possibly a bit too optimistic, but I'm expecting him to find a place in that 22. Because, I mean, Ryan Harwood got a lot of games last year, but I would hope that either Doherty... I mean, I'm not sure whether Doherty and Harwood can play in the same team, because they might be going for the same spot. But, I mean, Yeo's also showed a fair bit this preseason, and it wasn't too bad late last year. So
yeah.
I'm not sure what... Again, that's that third small defender who admittedly might not get a whole lot of points, but if it's Doherty who is rookie-priced... Even averaging a 50 would be a decent effort for a rookie back then.
Yeah, for sure. I guess he's a really big unknown as far as I'm concerned. From a draft perspective, you know, if you're drafting out to like say 200 or so, meaning that what you're looking at 50 or 60 defenders getting drafted.
I think yeah.
I think he battled to find his way into the top 50 or 60 defenders.
I guess the in terms of backs, it will be interesting to see whether because I mean Doherty did average 62. No, he's projected to average 62 this year, which is about on the cusp of fantasy relevance. So if he does manage to get a spot on that Brisbane half back line, he could be a good bench back. But yes, he's probably a late round flyer at best, I suppose, in draft leagues. And then Staker, he's obviously an unknown quantity. He might not even play at all this year, depending on how he recovers.
Or even which end of the ground that he plays.
Yep. In the centres, so we have Redden, Reigns, Maloney, Rich. I'm not expecting Black to play more than half a season at this stage, obviously with his ongoing issues. Pollock played a fair amount of games last season. It was about 13 to 14 last season.
Did he?
He did.
That snuck up.
Yeah, it did. So, I mean, he's, again, as a centre, averaging 65. I mean, unless he... averaging 54 last year. They've got him projected here as increasing by 10 points, but even so, that's barely on the cusp of fantasy relevance. So Maloney, obviously, he would be undervalued from last season, but also in the forwards, we can go with McGrath, who was mentioned earlier above in the backs. He will obviously hold down a forward pocket position. Zorko, obviously. Clay Beams, who a lot of people are expecting a lot of things out of Clay Beams this year from a fantasy perspective.
Yeah.
He is a sleeper, isn't enough. He?
Yeah, I think he's a decent chance to. Yeah, he's not going to improve as much as his brother did in 1 year. But he's someone who could pop up and he might average a 70 or 75 and be relevant.
Yep, Rockliffe in the forwards as well. So now Polkinghorne, it seems a bit like Harwood to me. Brisbane is a side we don't hear a whole lot about down here in Melbourne, and it's hard to find online fans who can sort of give us the inside goss on what actually happens up there in the club. Brisbane seems to me to have drafted a bunch of kids who have the qualities of Michael Voss himself. I think that Voss and or his recruiters seem to have tried to recreate or to find the next Michael Voss, a player who is so versatile that that they could play, forward, back, midfield, almost ruck. And it seems to me like Harwood, Polkinghorne and Canizes, we'll talk about a bit later, they're looking for the next Michael Voss. I'm not sure they've found one yet, but they're all these sort of in between types, which Voss himself might have been, but Voss had such quality and skill in him.
It was in between elite at everything, though.
That's right. So I mean, they're looking for another. Obviously, recruiters do tend to. I'm not sure whether that's actually the influence of the coach. Polkinghorne
was drafted before Voss was the coach there.
Right. Well, the recruiters do tend to recruit players in the image of the coach at certain clubs, and that's something which I think is happening a bit here in Brisbane. So I'm not sure with Polkinghorne and Harwood and Karnesis. These guys seem to me to be in the mould of a certain type of player, but I'm not sure they're big enough. They're good enough to hold that spot in the 22. They did last year, especially in the case of Polkinghorne and Harwood, whether other players will go past them.
He's a little bit of a different type of player to those guys, though. He's sort of more like a medium. He's been a medium forward who is looking to make a move into the midfield, but he's not that overly, like, he's not a hard inside player like Polkinghorne and Harwood.
Mm. Well, so yeah, Karnes is obviously. I mean, it does seem to me that when you hear of players who are over 190 centimetres who are being groomed for a midfield role, Dan, it smacks to me a little bit of desperation that we haven't found any other role for this bloke, because we can't play him at third tall defender or third tall or tall forward because he's no good at that position. So let's throw him into midfield and see if he can make a career out of himself. It strikes me as the Canisius being the case in point here, that I think the hierarchy down there have just thrown their hands up and think, well, I mean, this is his last chance, and if he doesn't do this, well, we can't really find a spot for him.
I guess the proof will be in the pudding. They seem to have been grooming him for this one for a little while because he had a pretty good first year playing playing as a third tall forward. I'm pretty sure that was 2011 where he had that solid year, but last year he didn't play much AFL and spent the year playing as a midfielder in the reserves. So, you know, even coming off in a pretty decent year, they've trialled him in the midfield for most of last year.
Yep. As far as the small forwards for Brisbane are concerned, I'm just looking at last year's numbers. Green, Buick and Banfield all seem to play about the same number of games, about 12 or 14 games. And I've sort of put those numbers in there again because I'm not quite sure whether...
Who wins the battle.
Who wins that positional battle? Because, I mean, they all have strengths and weaknesses. It might just be a horses for courses thing, or whoever's fit or whoever's in form. Maybe that's the way the boss likes to play them, that he likes to keep them, you know, lean and mean by ensuring their job security is on the line every week.
Yeah, no, it's fair call.
Sam Mays. Now, I haven't got Sam Mays predicted at anything. Is he actually going to be playing a lot this year, do you think, Dan?
Oh, I think he's a chance. Mark Harvey talked him up all the way back in November, not long after the draft, as someone who could come in and play some games for them this year. He's already got fantastic running capability, so there's from an endurance point of view, he should be able to cut it. You know, maybe as a medium forward playing his first year.
Well, I hope he's not the next Jared Pollock, because Pollock was certainly, from fantasy terms, a big disappointment in his early years. I've also not projected anything for Marco Paparone. Is it Paparone or Paparone?
Paparone.
Paparone, yes. Yeah. Yeah, so it's not like the pizza, is what you're saying to me. I think he has been given the nickname of Guns, which I think is an excellent nickname, Guns of Paparone. So I do like that. And just to round out the Brisbane discussion, so Stephen Martin, obviously playing the Lee Brown role, will play most games. Leuenberger and Longer, I suppose one of those, I'm not sure though, both of those guys can play in the team very long. I'm projecting Leuenberger to play 16 and Longer to play 6, so basically they'll cover for each other, I suppose.
Pretty much. And I guess Leuenberger, it's a bit of an unknown how he's going to bounce back from what was a really serious injury.
It is going to be interesting for private drafts to see how low people will reach for him, because I think
considering that in most leagues will be playing one ruckman on the ground, and if you're in say in a 10 team league, even a deeper league with 12 or 14 teams, there's probably someone that you could find with a bit more security than Leuenberger. Leuenberger could more be a backup ruckman for you.
This segment is going so long, we might have to actually break it into next week's show, but we'll push on.
You're probably right.
We'll push on. We'll see how far we get when we come up to the hour mark. We've only got about 10 or 15 minutes. So we'll get on to Carlton. So obviously Gibbs, Carazzo, we'll start with the talls. So Jamison, Henderson, I suppose we'll stick down with fullback. And then you've got Laidler and Dygan, Watson, White. They've got a number of blokes who can go through that third tall position.
They've got a fair bit of height back there, and guys that are all pretty ready, pretty AFL like standard. So no dramas there.
So are you? Do you put any credence to these talk of Nick Dygan possibly being a Carlton captain? Because if he is, his job security suddenly goes up fairly high.
Yeah, it would. I don't know that they'd drop the captain too much. I'm not. I think he's respected there as a leader and stuff. So it's hard to know what goes on behind the four walls there, because he's not been in the door that long. This is his third season he's coming into.
He was a mature age pickup.
Yeah. So obviously he's made a pretty big impression pretty quickly to be talked about in that light. So I guess we'll wait and see how it plays out. There's a few guys who'll be good captain for them. So I think I'm not going to go as far as saying spoilt for choice, but I think they've got a few solid options. It's hard to say which way it's going to go.
I mean, obviously, if Nick Dygan does get picked as captain, it's not going to be without precedent in the AFL. I mean, there have been other captains who are sort of borderline 22 who have,
Richard Vandenberg.
Richard Vandenberg. Nick Maxwell is obviously another one. Yep. Who, you know, well, I mean, he would have been borderline 22 looking from the outside, but maybe on the inside, his intangibles or the KPIs that they've set internally, he might be so far ahead of, on those ones.
We don't know what they are, so you know, he might be doing a lot more than what we can sort of see from, you know, watching games on TV or even going to them. He might be doing more than like what they're asking from him and more.
So. Yeah. So in terms of draftability, Dygan averaging just on 52 last year, the projection is for him to get towards 60 this year. Laidler, White, Watson, they're not really...
I don't think there's a lot... That's the thing, no. We're talking about them having a lot of options to throw through there. No. I don't think any of them are going to be particularly draft relevant.
Mm. But yes, if you are starting one of those guys during the season, that means you've been cruel by injury, unfortunately. But that's going to be something those guys will most likely be out in the waiver wire for you.
At the very least, you get some handy job security on your bench.
Yep. As far as the more small defenders, so Joseph has been playing some back pocket roles, obviously some midfield roles as well. Similarly with Ellard, he's been playing some forward but mostly forward and some back. But I suppose. Tui is one who I'm not quite sure about his job security.
I think they like him. Mm.
They do like him. It's a matter of, I mean, I don't know whether it's a fitness issue or not, but he's a player who could play 6 or he could play 22. I'm not quite sure at this stage.
I reckon he'll play a fair bit this year, but I don't think he'll be a fantasy relevant option. I just think, you know, they like getting the ball in his hands to go on and run in a dash.
Yep.
In a just sort of like a shorter version of Harry O'Brien, it's more about what he does with the runs that he goes on, the 10 times that he gets it.
Yeah. So obviously Yaron is he's fantasy relevant, yep. And he's assuming his hamstrings don't go ping as they often do, then he'll be the fantasy relevant small defender there because Joseph and Ellard, Joseph particularly is not a fantasy relevant player. Ellard. Well, now to look at it, Ellard did average 84 last year. So, but he's classified as a centre, so that's probably not as relevant for the backs. All right. So, as far as the centres go, we'll throw Gibbs and Carrazzo in there, even though they're positioned as backs, for the purposes of team structure.
How they line up, yeah.
And Scotland, obviously, also does play wing, even though he drifts back. So he's a midfielder nominally.
Handy having those three from a fantasy perspective as defenders. Gibbs did play in defence last year, but it does seem like this will be the year he actually moves into the midfield. We don't
Indeed.
Know yet.
So he averaged 92 last year, and he's projected here at 101.7. Do you actually believe that he's going to break 100 this year?
Well, I think he can. I'm reasonably confident that that Bryce Gibbs will have a solid improvement this year.
Hmm. All right, the rest of the Carlton midfield, Cade Simpson, Brock McLean, Mark Murphy, Simpson, McLean, Murphy all will play as much as they can. Judd, I mean, how much do we factor in his propensity for injury? Because I've predicted him there at 18 games, which is sort of the number that I'm expecting from those players who are expecting to ping one hamstring during the year. So
I don't know if you, we're just guessing if we're trying to pick, how many games Judd will miss by injury, but I think it's pretty viable to suggest that at the very least he'll get rested once or twice. If his body's holding up and he's not getting injured, he'll still probably miss games because he has a heavy workload.
Ed Curnow, I've projected at 14 games, which is about what he played last year, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, sort of pretty interchangeable, like Curnow.
He's going to be on the waiver wire or the free agent list, depending on which comp you play. He's going to be available there if you need to plug and play bloke. He's the sort of player who, unfortunately, is going to be the one who you'll be sweating over whether he's going to get 70, 80
out of
or
the 22.
Indeed. Ellard, as I mentioned. Now, this is a fraught question, I suppose, whether Kane Lucas and Tom Bell will actually see significant action this year. I think Lucas has got better JS, but Bell, I think, has got more upside. I like Bell as a player more than Lucas, but I don't know whether they're going to be able to fit into that Carlton midfield this year.
I guess when, inevitably a couple of injuries hit, and there are a couple of guys that are on the fringes that'll be, you know, ready to go. Bell over Lucas for me as well. Everything talked about Kane Lucas's preseason was glowing.
I think
he was pretty disappointing in the NAB Cup though, in that first round, Mickey Mouse games. But I thought we'd see a little bit more from him than that.
I heard in their first practice match that he played the Heath Scotland role. He sat out in the wing on his own, and got a lot of uncontested possessions and inside 50s, which is, I'm not sure that in a real AFL game that he'd actually be able to do that.
That can happen in an intra-club match. It's a bit harder for it to happen in an AFL match, though.
Right, so the Carlton tall forwards, obviously you've got Cruiser at centre-half forward, and Walker and Waite.
It's an interesting dynamic, you know, with their tools, you know, Hampson, Cruiser, Warnock. Like, I know that's sort of partly to do with their rucks, but inevitably, you know, they've got those three guys that it does become part of the tall forward discussion.
There's obviously a lot of fantasy hype around Sam Rowe, but I can't see
I think that fantasy hype is purely because he's a ruck forward, rookie-priced option, so it's more of a Dream Team Super Coach conversation, that one. I think he's got draft league relevance.
But it does affect a bloke like Sean Hampson, who might actually be an R2 in a private draft league. So, I mean, if Rowe goes past Hampson, for instance, then people who drafted Hampson can throw him away if Rowe, for whatever reason, goes past him. So,
yeah.
I mean, Hampson obviously does have some flaws to his game. I mean, a few blokes of that experience don't. So, and you've got Levi Casbolt there as the dark horse as well, who, as a forward, averaging sort of, you know, mid 60s, is also on the fringe of fantasy relevance.
Yeah, I like him. I might not draft him in the last rounds of fantasy drafts, but I'll definitely keep an eye on how he's tracking.
Ideally, I would like not to draft any of those guys because of the uncertainty. I'd like to not draft Sam Hampson, Rowe, Casbolt, or Andrew Collins, who might also dip in there for some games as well, because of the lack of job security for all those guys. As far as the small forwards go, so you've got Garlett and Betts, and then the third one, Dennis Armfield played a fair bit of forward tagging last year. Robinson also played some of that last year, so that's probably pretty much the rotations. It'll be, I mean, I'm not sure there's a huge amount of numbers there, games there for Collins or Fraser Dale, who's played a bit in the preseason. But yeah, that's I think that's fairly standard, that Garlett, Betts and Armfield or Robinson.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we'll do Collingwood now. Then we'll wrap it up, I think. So that's three we've done already. So yeah. Collingwood. Well, obviously we have Brown, Reed and Maxwell as the third tall.
None really relevant for our draft.
No, indeed.
The tall defenders rarely are.
Maxwell possibly, but he'll be either on your bench or on the waiver wire or the free agent list anyway. And the small defenders, Tuvi, Harry O'Brien and Heath Shaw. So I guess the question Jordan there, Russell, yeah, and the question there is where does Jordan Russell fit? So
I just think they rotate a few guys a little bit up the ground. So you know, these days, like just because in the newspaper there you've got six guys that, you know, play in, you know, you got a back pocket, a full back, another back pocket, you know, a couple of half back flanks and a centre half back. Yeah, they're gonna rotate guys through there. Jordan Russell off half back and up on the wing. But you know, I can see them pushing Heath Shaw up the ground a bit as well. If Russell needs to spend a little bit of time in, you know, back in defensive 50, I don't think there's much of a reason why Heath Shaw can't push up to a wing.
True.
Or Collingwood would love to play a plus one as well.
That's
so
true. So
seven men in defence, they're happy to do that.
So I'm projecting Russell to pretty much steal most of Marty Clark's games from last year. I'll predict Russell at 18 and Clark at 4. Would you expect that to be also the way it goes?
Yeah, that's a reasonable expectation. Mm. Yeah.
And that they do have a lot of small defenders, but I'm not sure a whole lot of them. I'm listing here Hartley, Ramsey, Frost, Yagmore, Williams, Oxley, Richmond. I'm not sure expecting any of those guys.
Richmond's a basketball player. Don't worry about him.
No.
And Jack Frost is a tall.
In terms of just, they do have a lot of back depth in general, tall and small. But I'm not sure a whole lot of those.
I think you've got a pretty settled back.
Yep.
Yeah, sort of like what we said. We talked about sort of seven players there. And another X factor is, once again, not fantasy relevant, but Lachie Keefe played some really good games before doing his knee last year, and he's expected back mid year, so he could be another one just to that'll get thrown into the fray.
Yep. In the midfield, so you've got Clinton Young still side bottom, Beams, Pendlebury, Swan. Luke Ball, now...
Pretty good midfielders there.
Indeed. So, Luke Ball, I guess, is the one... I've been hearing murmurs that his pre-season hasn't been all that great.
They're still expecting him to play the last round of the NAB Cup.
Mm.
And that being the case, if he does play in 2 weeks' time, you'd have to suggest that's been him being on track, because he did it in round 3 of last year, and if he was to get back 11 months later, then seems like he's on track. So I think that was the expectation from the outset.
Mm. But yeah, I mean, well, it's hard to tell whether he's going to start slowly and then sort of gather momentum in the second half of the year, or whether, I mean, we've seen players coming off those long term injuries have a down year, and then it takes actually 2 years for them to really get back to the scoring they were capable of. So. I mean, it's going to be fraught with danger picking Luke Ball, and it is going to be a late round pick, I'd imagine.
I think he can, we don't know, how he's going to come back from it exactly, because he has been a pretty quality scorer. I wouldn't be afraid to take him in towards the middle rounds. He's got good potential. I want to have a little bit of a discussion around. Let's just pretend Luke Ball comes back good. And he's in great form. Mm. Do you see it affecting any of their other midfielders who improved a lot last year? I'll say side bottom and Beams, just to throw a couple out there.
Now, I'd say the more the fringe ones. I'd expect Blair to play a lot more forward, because Blair sort of was covering for Ball last year
And did a good job.
Yeah, and there are some other forwards who sort of rotated through the midfield. Sinclairs and Elliotts and.
Yeah.
There were those sort of guys who were the cover for, and they got a lot more outside ball than the side bottom and Beams and Penner. We got a lot more of the inside ball, but I think there's still a lot of points to be shared around in that Collingwood midfield, because they haven't really solved the problem of their forward structure and so they're still going to be chipping the ball around a lot in midfield, because they haven't got their forward structure right, so they don't get it in there quickly. That's the midfielders are smart enough to know that if there's someone standing in front of Cloak, they don't kick it to him. So they'll try and play around him.
And also just on pure weight of quality. I mean, they've got so many quality players that it's Scott Pendlebury or Dane Beams. They're not going to take a backwards. They're not going to take a back seat. Because Swan's getting 45 touches.
Yep.
Or maybe side bottom breaks out and has will have a 35 touch game. It doesn't mean that there's any less ball for the other guys to get around.
Yep.
Plenty of ball to go around that Collingwood midfield, and they all find it.
Yep. As far as the forwards go, so I've got Blair there.
By the way, I want to throw in as a bit of a smoky for their midfield this year, Paul Seedsman.
Yeah, no. I was going to mention. Obviously, they've done well again at the draft table, getting Kyle Martin as well, and there's a couple other blokes there.
Sam Dwyer is another one. It's good depth players for them. Mm. If they don't break into the 22 at the start of the year, like we've talked about, how strong their midfield already is, and that's fine. They might not play straight away, but look, if a couple of injuries hit. I feel as though they've gone for a couple of guys that are just plug and play, ready to go. Going off the top of my head here, I reckon Kyle Martin might be about 22, 23. I reckon Sam Dwyer's about 26 years of age.
Right.
It's just a couple of guys who are ready to go. Like a bit low maintenance in a way. Like just put him in there and they'll do the trick.
And I have heard it said that you really do need to pay attention to Collingwood rookies, because when they get in the team, I mean, it's very hard to get in there, obviously, especially as a midfielder. When they get in the team, they score like crazy. So that's obviously a very important set of positional battles to keep your eye on.
Yeah.
Right, so as I said, so in the forwards, obviously you've got Cloak, you've got Lynch, and the third tall would possibly be Goldsack, and then McCaffer is the other possibility there.
A marking option, not overly tall, but they sort of they can play him in that role because he has a bit of, not so much height, but good overhead skills.
Now, I've got Goldsack there projected at 20 games and McCaffer at 12. I'm not sure they can play in the same team. I'm assuming that there aren't injuries elsewhere, but that's going to be interesting to see structurally whether they can play both of those guys.
Basically, when McCaffer went down last year, that's when Goldsack switched ends. Am I right?
That's right. That's right.
He played defence until last year.
That's right.
Moved forward, and he did a cracking job.
Yep, and look, I mean, as far as defenders go, I think the addition of Russell means that I'm not sure if McCaffer plays forward and Russell plays back, whether the Goldsack might get squeezed out of the team. I don't know, but
it'd be a tough call on what happened last year. But you try and pick 22 names that are going to play in the Collingwood side. Like, there's going to be some desperately unlucky players.
Yep. So as far as small forwards go, so it'll be Blair for Solo and probably Cracker. Although again, Cracker,
Jamie Elliott and Alan Didak are there too. This is exactly what I was just talking about a second ago. It's really hard to pick who's in their best 22, because there's a lot of guys who you could stake a very strong case for.
And we haven't even mentioned Dale Thomas there. Of course, he might not start. So yeah,
we haven't.
So I mean, I mean, they all added up to the right amount of games when I projected them on him. So I've still got Thomas at 16 and Cracker at 16 and a bunch of these blokes. But yes, they do have a lot of good kids, and I suppose we're going to see them at some point during the season, and that's going to mean that they only play when one of those guys who plays 20 to 22 games gets injured. And if they don't, then happy days for Collingwood, and they'll probably make the top four and play a prenup again. But it's hard to see. It's very hard to predict from this early stage. Who's gonna lose out?
Looking at those projections that you got there for the games on Jamie Elliott, I've got a pretty high opinion of him, and I reckon he's going to be one to make a bit of a move this year.
Well, you'd have to, again, this is one where all the games have to add up to 484, because there's those amount of spots. So who would you actually, so I've got him, I've got Elliot projected of 12, so if he gets 20, who do you take 8 off?
For me, Ben Sinclair.
So Sinclair at 4, and Elliot at 20.
No, I wouldn't take all of them off him. I'd probably take a couple of the solos too.
They do seem to rate for Solo fairly highly internally.
They do. I reckon they rate Elliott fairly highly too, though. So I think there could be some really interesting competition between for Solo and Elliott this year. Maybe Blair doesn't play 22 games.
I'm not even sure why Didak is playing on. I mean, with the quality they've got at the bottom of their list, I would have thought they might have pushed him out by this stage. But because I'm not sure he's going to be able to fit into that side, even playing well, he might have been better off going to a Gold Coast or a GWS.
He's been a fantastic player for so many years, but there's a big challenge for him this year, because there's a buttload of quality in front of him for sort of small forwards who can push up into the midfield at Collingwood.
Indeed, and just to round out that discussion of Collingwood, so Jolly, we've got projected at 16 because he is fairly injury-plagued at this stage in his career.
Yeah, later in his career anyway. He used to be the most durable one going around.
No.
But he's already stated that 22 games is too much for him to play in a season.
Yep.
Like, he specifically said that he'll rest at some stage.
So I've got Hudson projected at 6 games and Brody Grundy at 4, just because they'll probably want to blood him at some stage. But
you could split him any way you want. I think Jared Witts will also get a couple of opportunities, but once again, it's not really fantasy relevant.
Not for
draft league anyway.
I have moved off Brody Grundy. I had him at R4 in my dream team as Supercoach. I've moved off him because I think there's better In terms of a low price ruck in those competitions who will get games, I don't think Grundy is the answer there. So, but for the purposes of private draft leagues, I think if you're getting Jolly, you'd probably want to handcuff him with Hudson, I'd imagine. So, I mean,
yeah, that's probably fair. It seems like that's what they've got Hudson for. Just you know, like at the time they got Hudson, no, he was rookie listed. So no, they already had Grundy and Witz as like you know a couple of kids already in there, but don't want to throw him to the Wolves. Just get Hutto to give Jolly a bit of a chop out. So if you do get Jolly, I think Hudson's an excellent get as your second ruck because when Jolly misses, Hudson's more than likely to come in. It's very unless there's you know both of them injured or something. It's very unlikely that we'll see Grundy or Witz leading the ruck in a game this year.
Yep. Yep, look, and something where if you do have Jolly and Hudson and for whatever reason neither of them can play 1 week, then I don't think you'd be losing a whole lot if you just traded out Hudson for Grundy or Witz or whoever it is who's playing.
There'll always be someone on the waiver wire who's you know, getting a game who will just fill the spot for that week.
Yep, all right. Well, I think that'll wrap it up this week for the selection committee. This is I feel like we actually are playing a bit of a selection committee role. We're picking the teams for everyone.
Kind of weird just then.
Living up to the billing. All right. Well, we shall see everyone next week. I'm sorry about the problems with downloading the shows over the past week or so. Hopefully that will be fixed up this week, and everyone will be able to download tonight's show on iTunes and obviously through the RSS feeds and through the website. So we shall see you guys next week, and thanks, Dan, for coming on again.
Thanks for having me again, Monty.
All right, see ya.
See ya.